all around. First and foremost, I apologize for the tardiness that my committee is showing right now. It's unacceptable in my eyes. We set a standard last year in this committee to be on time, and I expect our committee meeting members to be on time, and I will reinforce that with a memo to them after this committee meeting. To say the least, I'm a little disgusted at this point in time. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 1614, Senator Daley, Small Business Regulatory Relief Act. Members, we have already discussed this bill at length. I believe Senator Daley has an author's amendment. We are going to discuss that amendment and then move the bill. The potential fiscal impact of this bill will be discussed in Finance Committee, but I will ask that Kevin Lundeen explain what this amendment would do to the fiscal note we saw last Wednesday. If I could have you do that to start it off here.
Okay, yes, Mr. Chair. Essentially, what the amendment is doing is making it clear that the board members that are appointed to this commission will not receive any compensation. As you recall, last week when we were looking at the fiscal note, and on the front page of the fiscal note is the $15,000 general fund expenditure, and what that estimate represented was the reimbursement of expenses to those public members participating in this commission.
Thank you, Mr. Lundeen. Senator Daley, you have an amendment.
I do, Mr. Chairman. It is the A2 amendment. Members, if you could just look at that just for a moment. It touches on what Kevin Lundeen was just talking about as far as the board compensation.
Senator,
if you look at...
Hang on one second. On the Daley A2 amendment, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Now explain the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If you look at line 1.7, it talks specifically about compensation and that board members shall serve without compensation, just as was previously discussed. The rest of the language is really cleanup language that I would just thank Stephanie James, our Senate counsel, for going through the language and making it more clear.
All right. Thank you very much. On the amendment,
no.
Senator Goodwin?
On the bill.
Or on the bill. Excuse me, Senator Goodwin.
Sure. I have one question, Mr. Chair and Senator Daley. I noticed that there are no members on your board of consumers. It all has to be small business or legislature, basically. Aren't we going to have representative consumers on the board that helps determine what the rules and regulations should be?
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, we looked at what other states had done. We had lengthy conversations. This is something that passed through the Jobs and Economic Committee, Economic Development Committee, and we did change the composition of the board based on the Jobs Committee conversation to add one member that is a small business owner by the governor. So the governor appoints an additional one, and we added a few legislators just to have it balanced so that it wouldn't be an odd number, so that each party in each caucus would have two. That's why we made those changes.
And as my understanding, Senator Daley, that the change of this membership was brought forth by Senator Metzen.
Senator Tomasoni, primarily, and I worked, reworked it and got it to a point where we were both comfortable with the language. And
right.
Senator Metzen also helped.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
Senator Daley, I'd like to work with you on this because I really do think it's only fair if some consumers get on this board so that there's a better balance. I'm with you on this. I think it's a good idea outside of the fact that, you know, we don't have any consumers to put their 2 cents worth in. So I think there needs to be a little better breakout, and maybe they didn't notice that in the last committee or didn't think about it, but I think it would be only fair. So I'm, you know, willing to vote for this now, but I would like to have a discussion with you about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Goodwin, I'll certainly follow up with you with the discussion.
Thank you.
I think also we should remind ourselves under Section 2, the creation and the purpose is primarily between the business and the regulatory side as well. But thank you for that offer. So any further discussion?
Yes.
Senator Wigger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Daley, I've had a few inquiries since the last hearing as to whether business supports this, or is the Chamber of Commerce or the Farm Bureau, other stakeholders, because I've had some business persons saying, isn't this just an unnecessary layer? It adds to the bureaucracy, and I agree with that point that the legislative committees in providing oversight can do that. Sure, Hawaii has done this and Wisconsin, but I haven't had a groundswell of support on this, so I'm wondering if you've heard from the business community specifically. And I agree with the point that the consumer voice isn't here, but has the business community expressed an opinion or others?
Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wieger, thank you for that question. They have, and they do support it. I have heard from several specific companies, different business leaders. One small business owner wanted to come in to testify in support of it. He just didn't have enough advance notice. He's busy doing his small business, and it's really hard to get away. Though it's important, he just was too busy.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, Senator Daley moves that Senate File 1614 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign?
No.
This bill will move on to finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Daley. Thank you, members.
Second item on the agenda is Senate File 993, Senator Newman. The Office of Administrative Hearings Disposition of Contested Case Hearings Requirement. Senator Newman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I know Senator Newman has an amendment set in our packets. Okay. We're passing it out right now. Senator Daley will move the A1 amendment. To that amendment, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, the A1 amendment changes the effective date. This bill was introduced last year, so we're a year behind. And it changes the effective date from 2012 to 2013. That's the change.
On that amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. To the bill, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, first of all, I'd like to indicate to you that I have Judge Eric Littman here at the table with me. He is the Chief Administrative Law Judge with
Assistant
Chief at OEH. OEH, Judge Littman, does not take a position either pro or con in terms of this bill, but I have asked Judge Littman to be here today in order to answer any questions that you may have with respect to the Office of Administrative Hearings in Chapter 14 that I am unable to answer. Very briefly, I wanted to give you sort of a summarized version of the Office of Administrative Hearings, or what I refer to as OEH, and Administrative Law Judges that I am going to refer to as ALJs. And the origins of administrative law go back many, many decades. But in 1975, the Minnesota legislature responded to continuing concerns about agency impartiality, consistency, and accountability in conducting their hearing and rulemaking responsibilities by establishing a new state agency then called the Office of Administrative Examiners. And this new agency, Office of Hearing Examiners, was to be administered by a chief hearing examiner that was to be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. In 1975, the legislature was also concerned about shielding these hearing examiners from political influence. So first, they classified the hearing examiners as employees in the state civil service, therefore subjecting them to all of the protections associated with that status. Secondly, the legislature explicitly required that hearing examiners be free of any political or economic association that would impair their ability to function officially in a fair and objective manner. If anyone would like to see a complete history of the Office of Administrative Hearings, I can tell you that former Assistant Chief Judge Bruce Johnson has prepared a report. I'd be more than happy to make that available to anyone that wants it. And in that, he goes into great detail regarding the history. In order to help you with following the purposes of Senate File 993, I want to bring your attention specifically to some definitions, some statutory definitions that are found in Section 14.02. First of all, under Subdivision 2, it defines an agency as meaning any state officer, board, commission, bureau, etc., that is authorized by law to adjudicate contested cases. Secondly, under Subdivision 3, a contested case is defined as a proceeding before an agency in which, and this is important, in which the legal rights, duties, or privileges of specific parties, that's your constituents, of specific parties, and are required by law to determine any constitutional rights in those hearings. Finally, under Subdivision 4, a rule is defined, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, means every agency statement of general applicability that is adopted to implement or make specific the law enforced or administered by an agency. I've read these statutes to you specifically because as I read them and in the course of administrative law, these are the laws that have a direct effect on the legal enforcement and interpretation and affect your constituents and my constituents. And in the end, it's the constituents and the citizens as to why I am here with this bill today. Under current law, some administrative agency versus constituent cases are decided by an administrative law judge and are final decisions. An example would be a veterans preference hearing or a revenue recapture hearing. However, in other cases, an ALJ is allowed to make only a recommendation to the commissioner of the state agency, with the commissioner retaining the authority to issue a final order, and that is an order that carries the force of law. An example of these would be, for instance, Department of Human Services involving daycare cases and the Public Utilities Commission. There are three reasons why I believe it is important to give OAH final decision-making authority in all agency-contested cases. And ultimately, I believe that would enhance public confidence in resolving these public cases. The first would be the consistency in application of statutes and rules governing the contested cases. With Senate File 993, agencies would not be permitted to rewrite findings of fact and conclusions of law following a public hearing and decision by an administrative law judge. In this regard, I would point out to you that OAH maintains strict oversight in its procedures and, in fact, on every case holds a peer review whereby a decision by an ALJ is peer-reviewed by another ALJ to make sure that there are no errors made in terms of the legal decisions in the case. The second reason why I believe this would be an appropriate measure for us to adopt would be to streamline and reform the procedure in reaching a final decision. In the current procedure, and I'm going to have Judge Lippman listen carefully to me as I recite this so I don't get it wrong. But in the current procedure, what happens is the commissioner issues a what's called a corrective order. The constituent then has a right to request a reconsideration of that requested order. If the constituent requests a hearing, in the event the commissioner denies the reconsideration, then there would be a contested hearing held before an administrative law judge. The administrative law judge, in its findings, issues a recommendation to the commissioner. The commissioner then reviews that final order and either affirms or modifies what the administrative law judge has done. The constituent then has a right to ask for a reconsideration of what the commissioner did. Assuming the commissioner then denies the reconsideration, the commissioner issues an order which is, in effect, finally we get to a final order. At that point, the constituent has a right to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and in my estimation, that is the first time that a constituent will have the ability to have his case heard before a tribunal that is not involved as a party to the original case. If this bill is adopted, Senate File 993, what I envision would happen is that we would skip the part where the recommendation to the commissioner is made. In other words, the administrative law judge would make a final decision, and the reconsideration of the administrative law judge's decision would be made on the merits of the case only in certain very narrow instances, such as fraud or newly discovered evidence that could not have reasonably been discovered previously or previous to the trial. And that's a rule that is very, very similar to motions of reconsideration that govern the district courts. The third reason why I believe Senate File 993 should be adopted is to provide our constituents with a fair and expeditious decision-making process wherein the decision-maker is a disinterested third party. And I think that this really goes to the heart of Senate File 993 and is the single most important consideration that I made in bringing this bill forward. Under current law, citizen litigants, which are private businesses, they're our constituents, they are the people who work for those private businesses, do not get a hearing by an independent fact finder with decision-making authority until they get to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I don't think that we should allow a state agency, which by definition is one of the parties to a contested hearing, to decide that contested case hearing or rewrite the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and the decision issued by the administrative law judge. We, the legislature, have allowed agencies to write these rules because under Minnesota law, Chapter 14, we give them rulemaking authority. We then allow, by statute, these agencies to administer or investigate violations of the rules that they have just written. And finally, we then put the agencies in a position of adjudicating and determining the legal rights of our citizens. It is my belief that we have to put our citizens, we have to put our constituents on equal footing with the government agencies. And to support this proposition, I just want to cite you very briefly an unpublished Minnesota Court of Appeals case, which I will be happy to provide you with the cite to following the hearing, which is in the matter of the revocation of the family child care license of Linda Beckman. And in that case, the Court of Appeals stated that the ability to recast the trial judge's findings and conclusions is a significant advantage for agencies, when defending an appeal of a decision. That is precisely the problem that our citizen litigants have in contesting the corrective action orders by state agencies. And I will tell you parenthetically that I have presided over those cases, and it is intimidating, to say the least, for our constituent, who is a business owner, to be sitting over here and to be confronted by several members of a state agency, plus the, say, the county attorney and other support staff. As I said, it is very, very intimidating. And it's simply not right, and it's not fair to allow the government to write the rules, which is a legislative function, to investigate violations of the rules that they have just written, and to allow them to sit in judgment. This is the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government all rolled into one. At this point, Mr. Chairman, I want to give you a couple of real quick examples. And I will tell you that I really have a great deal of difficulty in having constituents come forward and be active in the participation. I have compiled a list of what I call agency abuses, all from my constituents. And they all are the same. And I'll just give you an example. I got one here from the hotel and industry of a constituent that I talked to Thursday night. And in this, he is complaining about the fact that Minnesota Department of Health came in. What he wanted to do is serve pre-mixed waffles at his motel. And as a result of wanting to do that, this was in 2006, he just got it resolved. It cost him, in accordance with mandates from the Minnesota Department of Health, $30,000 in remodeling costs and $11,700 in penalties and fees assessed against this businessman by the Minnesota Department of Health. Now, here's the part that I also want you to listen to. This is an email to me. We ask you please keep confidentiality in this matter so that we do not become a target of the health department again. That's not my words. This is my constituent talking. And I will relate to you, members, that I hear that over and over and over again. And I would encourage you to go out into your district and talk to your constituents, the people who own businesses and who are applying for permits and having state agencies come in and investigate whether or not they are complying with the rules and see what they have to say. And I sincerely believe that your constituents are going to tell the same thing to you that my constituents are. An exception to that would be a constituent that I did ask to show up, and I've asked a lot of them, and one did today. And his name is Don Scheffelbein. He is a farmer from my district, and he is currently engaged in a pretty significant problem with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And with your permission, Mr. Chairman, I would ask Mr. Scheffelbein to come forward and briefly explain the problem that he is having with the Pollution Control Agency. And I ask Mr. Scheffelbein to come forward, Mr. Chairman and members, simply so that I can put a face to this problem of our constituents dealing with the various state agencies. This isn't specifically targeting the Pollution Control Agency. This problem that I am trying to address with Senate File 993, I will tell you, is statewide. I so far haven't bumped into any agencies that are an exception. This one happens to be the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Newman. Mr. Scheffelbein, before you get started here, and I just want to say one thing. After touring and spending the time that I did up at your facility, I must admit you are probably one of the best, if not the best, conservationist I have ever come across. And I applaud you for what you do with your operation. And with that, please introduce yourself, and you may testify.
Yes, Chairman, and the rest of the committee. My name is Don Schiefelbein from Kimball. I'm from a family farm, as Senator Newman explained, in Meeker, Wright, and Stearns County areas. And I guess let me just reiterate what Senator Newman said, because I want to make sure you understand the substance of what he said. When Senator Newman asked me to come testify, remember, we're a family organization. I didn't tell you how big a family, but there's 8 brothers, a father, and 2 nephews that all farm together. So we're substantial in terms of the numbers. As we approached this testimony, we bring it to the group, as we always do, and said, is it in the best interest of the farm to testify on behalf of Senator Newman? The vote was 8-1 of those voting not to testify. 8-1. Now, those of you who know my family, I'll tell you the one vote that voted that we should testify was my father. And my father said, you know, my dad, those of you who know my dad, some of you do, know that my dad said, Donnie, you got a point here. Your point decision now becomes is, what kind of government do you want in the future? If you want to stay quiet, you want to stay behind the scenes, that's fine. But then let's not be loud and obnoxious when things don't go our way. So he basically converted the whole group from that deal for me to come here today for you, Senator Newman. I also want to give the group just a brief background that I am also on the Minnesota Pollution Control Citizens Board. For those of you who are not familiar with that, that's a 9-member panel that basically hears kind of the controversial cases as well as any new rule changing that occurs. To Senator Newman's point, I happen to be the ag representative for that position, and over the past 6 to 9 months, I've had no less than 6 to 10 people who have come up to me and said, Donnie, what do I do? I've got the Minnesota Pollution Control Organization over here. I'm over here, but I'm just a small family farmer. What do I do? It's hard to give advice to that because you know the full weight of the Minnesota State Legislature with their Attorney General's offices over here, and here you sit as Farmer Joe over here. In almost every case, Senator Newman and the rest of the committee, on almost every case, what do you suppose they do when they confront with the MPCA? They go the least route of resistance. And for those, they look at it and say, I'm about to get fined $20,000 for something I probably didn't do, or at least not intentionally did. But my alternative is to take it through the court system, fight it on a terms where the battleground is basically on their area. So almost always what they will do is they'll negotiate to a point and say, I'll admit something I really didn't do, and I'll pay the fine. So just with that preface, I want to make sure you understood that. In our particular case, ours is pretty plain and simple, and it comes where regulation and environment right now does not have a whole lot of common sense to it. In my particular example, we are trying to expand our facility, our feedlot facility. It is going to be a non-discharge facility, which means everything is contained. The reason it has to be contained, it's by law, it must be contained, okay? So it has to be contained. Now, this is the part that where common sense breaks down in a large way. For this non-discharge facility, what permit do you suppose we need to get through the MPCA for a facility by law that can't discharge? Who's guessed it? A discharge permit. We are required by law to get a discharge permit, or we're required by law to have a discharge permit for a facility by law that is required not to discharge. Okay? That went through the national court battle, and it got flipped over. And the court system at the national level said that makes no sense. And they said you can't require it. This legislator, through the special session this past year, concurred and said, we're going to pass a rule that no longer requires someone who can't discharge to get a discharge permit. Everybody with me? However, now we're in the interim, right? The law passed. We want to expand. What kind of permit do we need to get now for our non-discharge facility? Because there is no permit for a non-discharge facility like ours. You guessed it, a discharge permit. That is the dilemma we're in, and I I don't mean by any means through my testimony to throw cold water on MPC as a whole, because I'm familiar with many of those guys in my role, and I know Commissioner Austin extremely well, and I'm telling you, he's a good and decent guy. It is a culture that needs changing. It is a culture that needs changing, not individual people. With that, Senator Perry and the rest of the committee, if you have any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them, but I very much appreciate this bill being pulled forward. I think it goes a long way in the right direction to right a ship that kind of has been wronged from an individual personal standpoint.
Thank you, Mr. Schiefelbein. Do we have any questions for Mr. Schiefelbein?
Mr. Chairman, I'm
wondering
if Mr. Schiefelbein would be willing to share with us how long he has been trying to get this permit from the MPCA, and how much his family intends to spend on this facility in that local area around Kimball. I'm not sure what, if he's willing to share that or not, but I'm willing to ask the question.
Mr. Schiefelbein?
Yes, Chairman Perry and the rest of the committee, I appreciate the question. I think from our perspective, it's just the level of difficulty in maintaining that we're very concerned about. Because basically right now we're forced down the road of only one permit choice, and that being a discharge permit. And with it comes a whole lot of hurdles, et cetera, that we have to jump through. Basically a process of about a year. The previous facility that Chairman Perry, you toured, and Senator Newman toured, it took us less than 3 months just to put through the whole thing because it's completely contained. Everything's contained on it. This one, they expect it'll take upwards to 9 months and about $3,000 additionally to get through. And that's where the rub hits. And also, there's no means right now for if we get this discharge permit, what is the process for us to go and get it transferred properly to a non-discharge facility with what it is. We expect financially to spend well over $1 million in the facility alone. More importantly, the turnover value of the animals in that facility exceeds about $6 million that directly goes into the economy of rural Minnesota in that Kimball area.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, a couple of issues. It occurs to me that it will be good for us to hear MPCA response to this, because I think that's the kind of the proper way for us to kind of get a sense of how do we correct this issue. So I would appreciate that if we have somebody in the audience that can help us understand this process. The second question is for you, Senator Newman. Newman, could you explain how the case of the testifier will be resolved with your legislation if we submit this case to the Office of the Administrative Hearings for disposition? How would that change the outcome?
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Torres Ray, the way I envision this would ultimately occur is that the parties who have a dispute with the various state agencies would have a right to go in front of an ALJ and have a decision made on the issuance of a permit, on a fine or a penalty that has resulted from some type of an investigation. What I'm trying to do is get a citizen like Mr. Schiefelbein with the ability to get in front of a decision maker who is not involved in the process and make a decision in the case, thereby speeding the process up.
Thank you, Mr.
Further?
Chairman.
All right. Any further discussion? All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your travel time. We did have a request for somebody from the MPCA. If we want to move down that track, otherwise, I think Mr. Judge Lippman, I believe you had. Were you going to have some testimony, or?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge. No, as Senator Newman suggested, I'm here if folks had questions about our process or Chapter 14.
All right. Senator Newman, do you have anything further?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chairman and members. I want to go through with you briefly what I anticipate will be the agency opposition to this bill. And in part, it's because I have been contacted by some of the agencies. In part, it's because this matter has already been heard in the House. So this is what I'm just going to alert you to what I think is coming. First of all, I believe that the agencies are going to argue that they have a greater degree of expertise in any given area. And I will tell you that I have read that testimony by the Assistant PCA Commissioner Beeman, who testified in the companion case over in the House. And I can tell you I also had a meeting with Commissioner Ken Peterson from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry on February 15th. And in that meeting, he told me that he felt that agencies have more expertise than administrative law judges in any given area. And in that regard, by extrapolation, I would indicate that in the judicial branch, expert witnesses are regularly allowed to testify and express opinions if it will help the fact finder reach a conclusion. But an expert in a judicial case would never be allowed to make the decision that they are offering to the judge or to the jury in terms of their expertise. The next issue that I think is going to come up is an argument that accountability exists for state agencies but not administrative law judges. And, you know, again, this came up with my conversation with Commissioner Peterson, and it also came to me in an email that I received from Dan Wolf, who is the Executive Secretary of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, and I believe you'll find a copy of that email in your packet. I'm really, really surprised by this argument that somehow the commissioners are accountable, but the chief judge over at ALJ or OAH is not accountable.
Senator Newman, maybe we could see if there's some agencies here that would like to testify specifically.
That would be fine.
Do we have any agencies that would like to please come forward?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As they approach, since it was brought on the record, the Public Utility Commission's concern on accountability, it's my understanding, according to Mr. Wolf's email to us, that they do not have a position, but they also make an argument about the additional caseload and some other policy considerations. And if there is anyone here, just as the ALJ is here, it might be helpful to hear from PUC.
All right, thank you. Please state your name and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ken Peterson. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you all for allowing me to testify. I'll be real quick and just try to respond to some of the things that Senator Newman has raised and so we can have a discussion, a conversation on this issue. First of all, I want to make it clear the administration does oppose this bill in terms of that it's for the reasons that Senator Newman mentioned. First of all, we think it lessens accountability in decision-making, and second, it'll lead to unpredictability and inconsistency in decision-making. Now, right there you've got Senator Newman saying one thing, saying it's going to honor more predictability. I'm saying it's going to be less predictable. Let me explain why. At our agency, and I think most other agencies, most of the time there's an agreement between the ALJ basically agrees with the agency. DHS sent me a thing this morning that said that 97 out of 100 cases they had last year in one area, I forget what it is, 97 out of 100 cases, the ALJ agreed with the department. I guess I should say that in 70 cases they agreed with the department, 30 cases they disagreed with the department, but the decision maker designated by the commissioner agreed with the ALJ on 27 of those cases. Basically, they convinced the department they were wrong. The ALJ convinced the department they were wrong and changed on the recommendation, so they changed their position. So only three out of the 100 cases were actually, the ALJ and the commissioner disagreed. So what we have here then is more of a question of difference, not in results. Well, I don't think there will be a great difference in results. I really don't. They'll be basically the same. Our cases show the same thing over at our department. I talked to some of our people. They said, we don't care. We'll win over with OAH, or we'll win with the way we do the commissioners. It is more of a question of philosophy. And the philosophy is, being that at ALJ, you know, we have very good ALJs, administrative law judges. They're very good. I have a lot of respect for them. They're good triers of fact. They understand the law. They really do. At the same time, they're all civil servants. They're protected by civil service rules and regulations. On the other hand, the commissioners or their designees are not. They're basically people that subject to the appointment of the governor and confirmation by the Senate. So there's a line of authority. They have terms of 4 years. At the OAH, the chief administrative law judge has a 6-year term, and then he has these people that work for her or him for years and years. So there's a less accountability. I want to really emphasize that if you want to have government, if you want to elect people and then have the government reflect with the views of the voters, then you want accountability, and you'll have more accountability under the present system. It's a good system. At the same time, once again, I want to reiterate, the results will not vary greatly. They really won't. Then on the issue of consistency and knowledge of the areas, ALJs, they're bright people. They're good people. They do a good job. At the same time, you look at the range of decisions made or types of activities undergone by state government, you can see that there's no way that 9 or 10 ALJs or however many there are that hear these cases, they're going to have the expertise in areas like some of the human services or labor and industry or pollution control or DNR or all the rest. They will not have that expertise. With that expertise, you will get, with the recommendations given by the ALJ to the commissioner or her, his designee, you'll have a consistency, first of all, a knowledgeable understanding of what's going on, plus a consistency from day to day, year to year in rulings. If you rely upon the ALJ system, you are going to have different judges looking at it. People one day may look at DNR, the next day working on something at DHS. They're not going to have that same kind of knowledge. They won't bring it with them every day. So you're going to lose that. At the same time, I want to reiterate, time and time again, I don't think the results are going to be that different. At our department, we have last year, I think, our OSHA cases are decided by the ALJs. And last year, for some reason, they accounted for about 60 or 70% of all the cases we brought. And we won every one of those cases we wanted. On the other side, we had we had a number of permits and licenses cases. And we won most of those, I guess. We had 5 or 6 of those, and the rest of them were OSHA cases. So the point is, this is it's a real philosophical question. It's not a question so much of you're going to get a different decision-making or citizens will feel differently. I think what we would propose is that the authors or this is a committee, ask the legislative auditor to gather some facts on this, find out if the experience of my department and DHS is true, are the decision-makers different from are the decisions different from the ALJs than they are from the commissioners, and are the litigants actually dissatisfied as to the process? We gather those facts, you deal some data, some solid data, and work from there. That'd be our recommendation. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any Senator Olson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question for Mr. Peterson, but I still am kind of curious as to if we could hear from the PUC as to why a discharge permit is the answer for a facility that will have no discharge because you're not allowed to by statute.
Senator Olson, hopefully we'll get to that point.
Thank you.
Any further questions for Mr. Peterson?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Commissioner, I am curious about the volume just for your office in terms of, let's say we adopt this change. What is the number that you think will be in any given year of cases that will have to be heard before the Office of Administrative Hearings for this position if we were to change that?
Commissioner Peterson.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, there wouldn't be any difference because the ALJs hear the cases, then they make a recommendation to the commissioner or his designee. You see, the way it works is that when we have a contested case, we designate, in our department, we designate an individual who's going to make the decision, and then we wall her or him off. In our department, we have three of us that here that make the final decisions, me, my deputy, and two assistants. Then we're walled off. Like, I'm walled off on two cases right now, which I know nothing about. And then it'll go over to the ALJ, assuming there's no settlement. It'll go to the ALJ. The ALJ will hold a hearing. Then they'll make a recommendation. They'll write out a series of recommendations. They'll set out the facts, then they'll set out their recommendations, and then they'll be given to the commissioner's designee. Then she or he, consulting with the attorney general's office on law, will make a decision. They'll whether accept the recommendation of the ALJ or reject it or take part of it or make a few changes, that sort of thing. That's how it works. And then the parties can appeal to the Court of Appeals, as Senator Newman pointed out earlier.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, Mr. Peterson, what you're suggesting, if I understand this correctly, would be a lot like the prosecuting attorney getting a recommendation from the judge and then deciding what they want to do with the case.
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, you allowed questions to go on too long. No, seriously, that's a very good question. But the point is, this is not the judicial branch. This is the administrative branch. The legislature has given instructions to the executive branch to make these sort of decisions. The fact that the ALJ has made his or her recommendations and their positions on the law will sort of educate the commissioner as to anything that she or he didn't know, and I think they'll come up with roughly the same decision. But it will allow that person to has more expertise. I think anybody who's dealt in these things, and I've looked at a number of them, that you look at, you read the ALJ decisions, and you understand that he really didn't know as much about the area as you do, and you can make some amendments, some changes to it. I have a thing from MnDOT where they said that an ALJ did a decision. It was a case between the city and a railroad over a grade crossing. And the ALJ made a decision on the cost, who should cover it, who shouldn't cover it. But then the MnDOT commissioner accepted that but ordered a modification that the city was responsible for safety measures, not the railroad. And so the ALJ probably wouldn't even thought of the safety measures for the crossing. It's that sort of thing that you need to have that we have in our system now that we won't have in this system.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Peterson, I thought I heard you actually making Senator Newman's case when we talk about the ALJs having six-year terms. They're independent of administrations and politics and majorities and minorities. And it would be my understanding that any information that an agency would like to make to the ALJ, that is incumbent upon them to give that at the hearing, and so therefore impart that knowledge to the ALJ for them to make that decision. So it would seem to me that Senator Newman's bill here makes perfect sense, and that it does remove politics out of this, and it leaves it in the hands of an impartial judge.
Thank you, Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, and to follow up with Commissioner Peterson, maybe directed, if I'm not sure where we are in terms of committee debate, but directed towards Senator Newman. Commissioner Peterson makes a good point, the extent that when the ALJ process was set up, it's an administrative process. It's not a judicial process as such. Wouldn't the ultimate answer to what you're trying to get at is simply to eliminate the ALJs and just turn everything over to the district court? Because then you have that separation that you're looking for, where the fact finder is not tied into the agency or vice versa, and simply have the district courts do everything. It would seem to me that would be the ultimate consequence of where you want to go, and would be more, it would possibly make more sense than what you have in front of us.
Senator Cohen, are you asking for Senator Newman to respond?
Sure. Is that
Senator Newman?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Cohen, decades and decades ago, legislatures around the nation decided that they were going to enact legislation relative to administration and its administrative rules. Certainly, this legislature has the legal authority to revoke or repeal the laws that establish OAH. And yes, we have the authority to send it back to the district courts. I don't know that that's necessarily a good idea. But what I do want to reiterate is that, yes, this is administrative law, and it's, administering laws and rules enacted by state agencies. But it's also determining the legal rights and privileges of our constituents. And I think that is what you really have to keep in mind here. Is it, you may have an idea that, gee, this is just administrative law. But the plain truth of it is that decisions are being made on a daily basis regarding our constituents' right to employment. It's their careers. It's their jobs. This is important stuff to people. And the agencies are determining our constituents' legal rights. I disagree with the premise that the agencies should be in control of writing the rules, administering the rules, and making the decisions. I'm trying to get that decision-making process over to an independent body that can decide these cases and level the playing field for our constituents. That's what I'm trying to do.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Sir Newman, I understand that. And that's why, because when we talk about the rulemaking authority, you're not suggesting that the legislature take that over. I mean, we'll be in session 14 months out of the year if we're going to take over rulemaking from the agencies. We have a tough enough time writing the basic statutes and finishing a session on time, much less taking over rulemaking. So, and I understand that you're not suggesting that the legislature take over rulemaking, but that would be if you really wanted to have some kind of separation of powers in terms of promulgation of rules, would you toss it back to the legislature? But what I understand with the concerns you've brought up, and I appreciate your constituent who testified, and I'm obviously not conversant, I was thinking for those of us who've been here for a few years, all of a sudden I heard kind of the specter of the feedlot debates coming back up, and we went through those interminably over a several-year period. And for those of us from the cities, it was very interesting, and I learned quite a bit about feedlots, more than I ever thought I would. Although I do have to offer a parenthetical comment, because I think we all have folks from our district who come, and whether they're officially a whistleblower or not, you would like to have some confidence. When you talk about the previous instance of a hotel or motel owner in your district having a fight, I'll bet it wouldn't be difficult to figure out who that what that individual business is, because there can't be a lot of them from your district relative to a hotel or motel fight. But if you're looking, that's what I'm trying to figure out with this legislation. If you're looking to affect some kind of demarcation and a wall between the fact finder and the place responsible for promulgation of the ultimate rule, then maybe what we should do is what you've suggested was the case decades ago, whenever the law was first implemented. The Court of Appeals becomes the appellate place, as obviously from the district court. Why don't we go back to the district courts, then being the arbitrator? And because there is not that wall of demarcation between the OAJ, the OAH office, and the agencies, it's not set up that way. And so if your concern is to make sure individual litigants, citizens, whatever, have that demarcation, then the way to do it is to go back to the district court. So why wouldn't we do that?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Newman,
at this point, if I could ask Judge Littman to come forward. There's been a number of questions that have been raised. Senator Cohen asks whether or not there is, in fact, a line of demarcation between the agencies and OAH. Commissioner Peterson has raised the question of whether or not administrative law judges have the expertise to handle these cases and whether or not there is consistency and accountability. And I wonder if we could have Judge Littman just comment on those issues.
We will, and I think I will ask you. We have two bills we are going to hear yet today, but if I may make a statement, first and foremost, true accountability will never happen until the legislature takes back what is their authority. And yes, Senator Cohen, if I had my druthers, all rulemaking would fall back where accountability is measured through an election certificate not so easily given away by the legislature to those that are not elected by the people. So, Senator Cohen, afterwards, you and I could debate that forever. If you want to give up your authority as a legislative elected legislator, that's fine, but we could argue with that. I'm going to turn now to Judge Lippman, if you would like to respond.
Mr. Chairman, members, very briefly, just to answer the three questions, I think Senator Newman correctly stated the law, which is that these matters, these disputes, could be referred to the Article 6 state courts. I think the key case standing for that proposition is Riley versus Jankowski. Said that any the Court of Appeals has held that anything, any addition to the law that happened after statehood, anything that wasn't at common law, can be referred to any forum that you see fit. It can be referred to OAH, a tribunal, independent tribunal in the executive branch. It could be referred to the state courts as you see fit. And so you entirely have the choice in aiming the hose, as it were. With respect to consistency and accountability, again, I think Commissioner Peterson testified correctly and accurately, which is that in the main, there's a high rate of affirmance of decisions that are considered later by the final decision-making authority. And again, I think it's characterized well by Commissioner Peterson as a philosophical debate. Senator Newman's on one side by saying he hopes to contribute to public confidence by having OAH ALJs more independent than was originally contemplated by the Minnesota Administrative Procedures Act. Commissioner Peterson would maintain the innovation that was made in 1975 by saying that there's an independent tribunal, but just as a checking function, the commissioner or agency head gets a check-in before it goes to the Court of Appeals. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Do we have other testifiers that would like to come forth? We've been moving along at about an hour clip here, and I want to make sure everyone has a chance. Somebody here from the MPCA that would like to make testimony? If so, please come forward. Please state your name.
Chair, committee members, my name is Kirk Adelka. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And there were a few questions dealing with permitting of feedlots. I just wanted to help answer those questions real quickly. Before last legislative session, there was a situation where there were two permits that a feedlot operation would need to get. One was a federal MPDES permit, and one was a state SDS permit. We in Minnesota had put those permits together in one general permit, and a general permit in Minnesota is designed as a cookie cutter so that it's a more basic permit, and if you hit these type of requirements, you can get the permit in a much quicker fashion than us designing a permit specifically for your facility and any other differences. Last year, the legislature did, let me back up a little bit more. Before last legislative session, there were some court rulings on the federal level that changed when a person would need to get the federal MPDES permit when they were required. And the legislature last year then made the changes so that they would disconnect the state and federal feedlot permits. Right now, the MPCA is going through rulemaking to make that happen. There needs to be some changes in our rules regarding the SDS permit and the NPDS permit. And through this process, we will create a general SDS permit, which could be a separate permit an individual can get. Farmers could still get a NPDS permit and be protected under federal law and its various requirements and its protections offered, or those that need the state permit, which is over 1,000 animal units, can get a separate SDS permit. Currently, if a farmer over 1,000 animal units, they have the choice to get the joint MPDS SDS, the joint federal and state permit, which is available today, or you could get an individual SDS permit if you just want the state permit today. It would take a little longer. It would cost a little bit more. And then eventually, at the end of this year, we hope to have a general SDS permit, which would be much quicker for a producer to get and in a cheaper fashion. So that is the kind of the framework right now for the permitting systems. This legislation here, just to bring it back to Senate File 993, would not affect how folks choose their permits. That is a separate issue from this legislation.
All right, thank you. Any questions? All right, seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. Any further questions on 993? Not, Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, I move that Senate File 933, as amended, be recommended to pass.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, I just make the comment then that I understand, Senator Newman, what you're trying to accomplish, I think. But, Mr. Chairman, you make the point more cogently than I did, that we should simply go to a system that has a clear line of demarcation. I'm not suggesting that OAH is that the individuals there are not of competence, not just Judge Lippman, but the others are any that I've dealt with, I think, are highly competent. But the process was set up within state government. And so if it's a question of trying to get some better sense of accountability and demarcation, this bill doesn't do it. This bill arguably just kind of continues that same mix. So, Mr. Chairman, we should go, I mean, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, we should then go in your direction and look for a system that puts authority back with the elected officials. I mean, we had something like this that X number of years ago where the large judicial districts in the state use referees to assist the judges. The referees are appointed by judges. They're not elected by anybody. And there were some of us on the side of we should have judges doing this work. The ultimate compromise was to allow the referees to continue. Their order would have to be countersigned by a district court judge, and that order was subject to a right of review, an automatic right of review by an elected district court judge. So that's another example of where we've ceded authority to a non-elected individual. So that's why, Senator Newman, if what you want to do is to make sure the agencies are not in charge of the rulemaking, fine. Then we should simply abolish Chapter 16, whatever it is, and go in Senator Perry's direction. And until we have that consistency, then I would suggest we vote, against your bill.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. Senator Daley renews his motion that Senate File 993, as amended, be recommended to pass. All in favor, signify by Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, earlier I acknowledged the email from the Public Utilities Commission. Is there anyone representing the Public Utilities Commission that wants to weigh in?
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, again, what about PUC?
We've asked. I've asked three times, committee. If they don't want to come, I cannot force them at this point in time. On the motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. And 993 will be moved forward. Thank you, Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Next on the agenda is Senator Nienau. Senate File 1457, Legislators and Governor Compensation Suspension Until Budget Bill Passage. Welcome, Senator Nienau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Interestingly, this bill actually is, if it were to move out of this committee, a part of a two-bill package that I see working in conjunction. I had initially submitted these, and they were both referred to this committee, and they were both they were showing as being referred to this committee. But the other proposal actually was ultimately sent directly to finance. So as I speak about this bill, I might speak a little bit about this proposal in the context of the other bill, but understanding that bill is not before this committee, It probably is not completely appropriate for us to get into the details of the other proposal, but they do go a little bit hand in hand. This particular proposal was a bill that I introduced late last year. I had the bill jacketed and drafted and ready and sitting on my desk, I think before session even started, because it was a proposal that I had submitted in my previous term. Most of you are aware that I'm in a second non-consecutive term, and I've had the fortune or misfortune of serving through two state government shutdowns. I've experienced them both. And as a side note, I was a participant in suing both the Republican and the Democrat governor when they wanted to spend money without legislative approval because I viewed that as not constitutional. But this proposal is intended to provide an incentive, and I do believe it needs to be in the context of my other bill, which is I refer to as the Lights On proposal, provide an incentive for the legislature to negotiate in good faith with the governor and hopefully provide an incentive for a governor to negotiate in good faith with the legislature and not play the game of brinksmanship that has happened at least now three times in the last 10 or 11 years under a third-party governor, Ventura. They literally, Senator Cohen might recall this, he was here at the time, under Governor Jesse Ventura, literally getting to, I think, about the 59th minute of the 11th hour before a government shutdown. And then under Governor Plenty, we had that experience, and then under Governor Dayton, we had that experience as well. Quite simply, it just says nobody gets paid or compensated for expenses if, indeed, we get to the point of a shutdown. And if the state does get to the point of a shutdown, at least under current law, the culpability there goes three ways, because the governor, the House, and the Senate could not come to an agreement and keep government operational. Somehow that one or two or three legs of that three-legged stool broke down. Now, this, in the context of my other proposal, I'll just briefly get into that, the Lights On proposal, that bill would keep government operational. If I get a hearing, I do intend to present that to the committee with a little bit of a circuit breaker so that we can keep government operational, but that would not necessarily happen in perpetuity. And in the event that we still ended up with a Lights On law, in the event that we still end up with a government shutdown, then this secondary incentive, if you will, or this incentive would come into place. That's probably about as much as I should go into the Lights On proposal because we don't have it in front of us today. But, Mr. Chairman, that is it in a nutshell, and I would be happy to answer any questions or engage in whatever discussion the committee would like.
Thank you, Senator Nienau, for bringing this forward. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify before we take questions from members? Seeing none, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Nienau, you have listed May 31st on here. The budget, I believe, starts July 1st. Should that be June 30th? Or are you penalizing one extra month for not having come to grips with a budget?
Senator Carlson. I think that initially was supposed to be drafted with June 31st. I didn't catch that difference. So that may be something that the committee will offer up as an amendment to the bill.
Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nienau, I'm likely to support the bill, but boy, I always enjoy these bills that this is not to speak critically of Senator Nienau, it's to speak critically of all of us. I always enjoy these bills that make sure that after the fact we do what we think we should do. And obviously there was nothing to keep any member of the legislature from determining in June or maybe more accurately, as Senator Carlson points out, July, that we hadn't finished our work. I'm not here to write press releases for myself. In my case, I've never taken per diem during the interim, whether it's a special session or for any other purpose, ever. I took the salary in July and donated it and made sure I donated it to a place where I thought was parallel to what was going on, but did so to a place where I can't take a charitable deduction. So I wouldn't be able to get some of that money back in that fashion. Many others did that as well. I thought it was striking that House members refused pay, and then X number of them, knowing they could get the pay back, took the pay back, and of course, rightfully should, blew up in their faces. So I appreciate the legislation, but what's to keep us from doing what we think is appropriate in the first place? Obviously, you think we need kind of the, if the approach is the cliche, the carrot or the stick, we need the stick, is what you're saying. We're not competent on our own without the stick. Is that a fair statement?
Senator Nino.
Mr. Chair, this idea originally came about for me right around the time of the first shutdown because the legislature passed its own budget. So the legislature had approved its own salaries already. And so in that context, I thought, well, that just doesn't seem right, that we're going to shut down the entire rest of government, but the legislature decided to vote to pay itself. So that's when the idea for this legislation came about. Now, this year, it's additionally pertinent because of what I believe to be unconstitutional actions by the executive branch. When people were calling me saying, hey, when you guys have a shutdown, you shouldn't get paid, my answer was, we won't. We haven't passed a budget. Article 1, Section 1 of the Minnesota State Constitution says we cannot get paid. We did not have an appropriation in law. Now, the executive branch went to the courts and said, the Constitution notwithstanding, we think we should spend some money here. And the courts agreed, and subsequently then a number of us filed suit to stop that. This legislation, and unfortunately, the Supreme Court, because a budget was resolved before we had a hearing in the Supreme Court, then the court dismissed it because the point was moot. I don't think that if the legislature decides to pass its own salary and shut down the rest of government, that should happen. I don't know that that would happen again, but if should that circumstance ever arise again, I would like it to be explicitly in law that if we pass a state government budget, even if our salaries are included, no, we're carved out. And if we ever end up in a situation where the executive branch again appeals to the courts to try to expend money without an appropriation in law, which I believe to be a direct violation of constitutional language, legal nuances notwithstanding, you know, schools are maybe a constitutional allocation that you could argue should go forward, standing appropriation, things like that. But those legal nuances notwithstanding, I do not believe, I believe my answer to my constituents that no one's going to get paid. There is no appropriation for the legislature. I think that should be the proper answer. And if indeed we get to the point where we have a governor that wants to expend money without an appropriation in law, I will again, if I'm in the legislature, be a participant in that lawsuit to stop that, or at least get a Supreme Court decision as to whether that truly is constitutional. But while that is pending, I think we should have this in law so that it is that the courts don't say yes, go ahead and pay the legislative salaries.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just out of curiosity, Senator Newman, did you accept your salary or per diem when we were in special sessions?
Senator Nino.
Is that for Senator Nino or Newman?
It's for you.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, yes, I did, and I actually had a question from someone from the Star Tribune. I said, hey, aren't you author of this bill in the past? And I said, absolutely. But what good will it do? What incentive did it provide to you for Senator Cohen to say, I don't want the salary, I'm giving it away? None. What incentive did it provide to Senator Lilly for those members of the Senate? I don't know what Senator Lilly did or didn't do with the salary. What incentive did it provide for him to have Senator Perry say, I don't want my salary? None. But when it's collectively applied to the entire body, everybody has the incentive. And I think that's what needs to take place to ensure that there's proper incentive in the context of, again, my other bill. I don't think that we should have the shutdown used as a political tool, and I think a lights-on proposal would be beneficial if we had it in law, but that's apparently for the Finance Committee, not this committee.
Thank you. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you. Senator Nino, I believe it's quite the opposite. I want on the record that the salary is really not truly an incentive to come here and do my work. It might be for you, but it isn't for me. In fact, I just do not believe that we are being paid really the way we are supposed to. So to say in law that I will not be paid because, you know, that is the incentive to do my work, I find it quite offensive. I think that now that none of us are going to be paid, I do appreciate that because it gives us the freedom to stay here for as long as we need to, doing the work that we need to do for the state. Because now those individuals from the Star Tribune that ask you whether or not you took the pay are not going to be coming. I took the pay as well because it just so happened that this is my only income. So I do need it. Absolutely, I do need it. And my constituents know that very well. They actually call me and say, please, Senator, do take because we know that you work full time. So I did take it, and I am not really ashamed of it. And what this does now is that all of us will not take it. We will stay here for as long as we need to without having to tell the media, you took it, you didn't, so now let's go after this senator because he didn't or she didn't. And I think this is wrong.
Any further discussion? Otherwise, I think Senator Carlson had an amendment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess hopefully this is a friendly amendment that we would, on line 1.9, strike May 31st and insert June 30th.
Mr. Chair. Yeah, that is the intent. It was simply I didn't notice that after the drafting was done.
Counsel, could you articulate, please?
Mr. Chair, members, the governor gets a few days to sign the bills after they're passed. I understand it's 3 days during session and 14 days out of session. So you might want to set this deadline a little bit earlier to give the governor – this is the deadline, by the way, for the legislature to pass its bills. So you might want enough time for the governor to sign the bills before the budget is
– So would you suggest something like July 3rd? I mean, are you?
No, I was going earlier.
Three days earlier.
Yeah.
Okay, like the 27th.
June 15th, since you're probably out of session in June.
Okay. Senator Carlson, is that?
It's fine.
Okay. So it would line 1.9 would read salary or per diem living expenses, and the governor may not receive salary after June 15th. To that amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye opposed. Amendment prevails.
Mr. Chair.
Any further discussion on the bill? Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, the question is, Senator Nino, at line 1.9, would it also be your intent to include housing?
Senator Newman.
Mr. Chair, that I believe would be covered by living expenses.
Thank you. Senator Cohen.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just thinking with the discussion between Senator Carlson and counsel relative to the date. Sometimes I think these sessions drag on way too long. Would we consider April 1st?
Good, thank you.
And then we could, you know, really get our work done.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. We're ready to move the bill. All those, let's see, who... we had Senator Carlson.
Just one more question for Senator Nino, Mr. Chair. Senator, this indicates, I guess I just missed this up until just now. This doesn't require the governor to either veto or accept the bill. It just says passed a budget and sent it to the governor, which this legislature did. So in that case, even though the governor vetoed, does that mean we would still be collecting? I guess we probably need to clarify this. Otherwise, this is probably.
Senator Nino.
Mr. Chairman, that is the way the bill is written. Again, I alluded to this is in the context of two bills that I had intended to have presented simultaneously with a lights on proposal so that we prevent a shutdown. This was intended to guarantee that the legislature does indeed present a full budget to the governor and cannot play the game of not sending a complete balanced budget to the governor. The lights on proposal then in the event that the governor disagreed with that, vetoed it, or whatever the case might be, the lights on proposal would prevent a gubernatorial, or excuse me, would prevent a government shutdown. So Senator Carlson, your reading of that is correct. Unfortunately, I don't have the two bills in front of us to be able to argue the merits of the two of them side by side. That probably wouldn't happen until it gets to the Finance Committee when the two of them are together.
This will be going to Finance. We referred to Finance, Senator Carlson. So, Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, I think you raised a good point because there is the sanction that the governor would not receive anything. You wanted to address the legislature, but I agree to include the governor, and to that extent, I would move at line 1.10 to strike presented to and after governor, insert, has signed.
That makes sense.
Council, did you follow that?
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Wigger has moved to amend on line 10, deleting presented to and inserting after governor has signed.
Senator Newman. Or me now.
Mr. Chair, you know, in the context of, again, it's a little bit of a discombobulated situation with this other bill being sent directly to finance, but in the context of that other bill, I think that would be fine. With the two of them together, I don't think that does any harm to the intent of the two working together.
All right. On the Wigger amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1457, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On the Carlson motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. So moved. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members,
Senator,
thank you very
Nino.
Much. Appreciate it.
Next item on the agenda will be Senate File 1922, Senator Peterson, State Agency Rules Review and Reporting Methods Provision Modifications.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you. Recognizing that several of us have a 3 o'clock committee, is it your intent for us to act on Senator Peterson's proposal today or to hear testimony?
That would be my intent. We have this room until 3 o'clock, and I intend to keep this committee meeting going. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. First, I'd like to just to take a look at the A1 amendment to get the bill into the proper form for consideration. And if it's not too much trouble, Ms. James, would you be willing to address that for the committee? It's primarily just housekeeping and numerical type changes.
All right, Senator Peterson, thank you very much. Senator Daley?
I can move that for Senator Peterson. Is it the A1? The A1 amendment.
On the A1 amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Senator Peterson to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also have an oral amendment. If you could direct your attention to the actual bill on page 10, line 10.8. I need to strike reviser of statutes.
So, Senator Peterson, what you're saying is you would like to see the on line 10.8. Say that again.
To strike the words reviser of statutes.
Ms. James?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe to accomplish what Senator Peterson has asked to do here, we on line 10.7, we would want to add after the comma the word and. And on line 10.8, delete the words, and the reviser of statutes.
All right, thank you. Senator Daley would make that amendment, oral amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Member prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. On Senate File 1299, as you have it before you with those minor corrections, I certainly want to thank the other authors on this bill. We have Senator Bach, Senator rest Senator Nienow and Senator Benson as well. And this bill in front of you kind of represents a significant compromise. Many of you may remember a bill we had that I was working on last year that dealt with some moratorium language specifically dealing with water rules. As that bill ended up, it ended up really turning into a study. Those five agencies are going to study the overlap of those rules relating to water and have a report back for this body in January 15th of 2013. To work off of that work that was done last year, what this bill does is it simply asks the Legislative Coordinating Commission to review a rule before it's implemented. I think we can agree that many of the rule process is fairly complicated, and this just simply makes it a little bit more clear and easy to understand. It's simply just one more stop, one more double check, an off-ramp, so to speak, so that a group of elected officials from this legislature has a chance to take one last look at a rule to make sure that its legislative intent is met before it goes into play. So really the steps in this bill, as we walk through them here, first the rule process stays exactly the same. And then the last step would be the Legislative Coordinating Commission, where it would review the objectives and the SONAR, which is the statement of need that many of you know about as we move forward through the rule process. The Legislative Coordinating Commission would then get 30 days to look at it and get an answer back for the agency to respond. The agencies would have 15 days to respond to any concerns that LCC might have, and then make a decision on whether it passes or fails. If it fails, we just simply ask for an additional 12 months. So if the LCC says that the rule does not meet the criteria spelled out on page one of the bill, that it would just not go into effect for 12 months, just giving the legislature a year to address it. If nothing happens in the legislature, the rule goes into effect just as it would have normally been planned. So I know this group's done a lot of work on the Sunset Commission, so to give you a picture of what might happen, new rules would go to the LCC, and then the old rules would go to the Sunset Commission, where they're charged with adding some specificity to older rules, as well as maybe a recommendation to do something different. I think this bill is clearly in the spirit of what the governor talked about in his State of the State address, where he is looking for legislation that's bipartisan and has been worked on both sides. I think you can see that's clear by Senator Bach's willingness to participate on this bill, as well as Senator Rest in trying to meet and accomplish what the governor's asked for. I think what you'll hear in terms of testimony relating specifically to this bill that we've seen before, at least I've seen it before, it's a response from the executive branch that Governor Plenty had a similar response as the governor does now. And if you, I guess I'll wait and see if you actually have that letter. I'm not sure. Was that distributed with any of the information? Okay. I'll wait to respond to that and see where that goes later on in the testimony here. But I did meet with the governor's staff this morning, Mr. Will Seifert, as many of you know, and talked with him about this bill, among other things. And I know one thing, he was concerned about this process taking longer. That is not the case. This will add no length to the rulemaking process by sending it to the LCC. Some information that was sent out this morning, I guess I'd like to read to you if I could get it specifically. There's absolutely some inaccurate information being disseminated. This came out on Minnesota Environmental Partnerships hot list. This morning it says Senate File 1922, this bill repeals all rules from five state agencies that protect our health, our air, our water, and puts higher value on corporate special interests other than public health. And that is absolutely false, members. The only time a rule is repealed, and you'll see later on in the bill if you want to get into the detail of it, the section right before the repealer section
a bill is only repealed if our agencies don't act in a time frame that's very reasonable, in our view. And the time frame that's allowed in this bill, you may hear a little bit about how our agencies might respond to emergency rules from various agencies. We're still taking comments from the agencies. I think at last count, I think there were 6 or 7 commissioners in the room, and I have not met with any of them yet on this bill, despite the attention it seems to be drawing at this point. With that, I'll certainly stand for questions. I think is a solid summary. Depending on your direction, Mr. Chair, I know there is folks here that would like to testify in favor
of
it as well.
Thank you, Senator Peterson. We do have testifiers lined up. I believe the first one is Mr. Steve, is it Morphy, Executive Director, Minnesota Environmental Partnership.
Mr. Chairman, that's what happens when you disappear from this place.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator Cohen. I'd be Steve Morse, and it rhymes with horse.
Oh, all right. Former senator, is that what I heard?
Yes, that would be true, too.
My mistake. I'm probably one of the youngest ones. I don't have all the institutional knowledge from years and years of serving in the Senate like Senator Cohen does.
Understandable,
we
Mr.
Together,
Chairman. And,
so.
And believe me, after you leave here, things turn over, relatively rapidly. So thanks for the opportunity to testify today. For the record, my name is Steve Morse, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership that was just referenced here. We are the state's largest environmental conservation coalition, made up of about more than 75 environmental conservation groups representing a combined membership of more than 450,000 Minnesotans. And yes, I did have the pleasure of serving in this body, came in with Senator Cohen, served 12-plus years. But perhaps more appropriately or more interestingly for this bill today, I also had the pleasure or the duty of serving as Deputy Commissioner of the State DNR under Governor Ventura. So I had a lot of responsibility for agency rule implementation during my time at the DNR. So with that as a little background, let me present my testimony. On behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, we are very surprised to see a bill like this introduced. And I'll address Senator Peterson's comments here in a minute. We recognize that the legislature has a legitimate and appropriate oversight of agency rules, and we agree that it's very important that legislators do monitor them and make sure that rules properly reflect the laws that have been put into place. That oversight process demands time and resources, and we appreciate the fact that the Legislative Coordinating Commission that has come up earlier plays a role in periodically reviewing agencies and rules. We also agree that agencies themselves should periodically review their own rules and eliminate any that don't make sense at the current time. But the truth is, this process already exists, and agencies do propose changes just for these reasons. Minnesota Section 14.05 sub 5 provides for this review and requires agency to submit a list by December 1st of each year that includes all unnecessary, duplicative, and obsolete rules. We'd suggest that Senate File 1922 is counterproductive. It unfairly and without explanation singles out environment, natural resource, and ag agencies for special attentions. And what I'm specifically calling your attention to is Section 13, Subdivision 2, that in fact is a rule of sunset. It says that the rules of these agencies are repealed August 1st, 2013, unless a new law is enacted after the effective date, providing that they'll be continued. Now, in plain English, that is a repealer. Now, there is a way to undo the repealer, but in fact, it is a repealer of all laws that protect our air, our health, pipeline safety, you name it. What this will do is it'll create a massive new bureaucracy for these agencies where they'll be forced to turn their attention from doing their jobs to producing reports and defending, or should I say, redefending their rules. Because, in fact, there already is a process in place so that when rules are adopted, there is a public input process, and there is no need to bring each and every rule back again for legislative approval. A public hearing process is held for significant rules and also when 25 citizens request that there be a hearing. It is important that we just step back a little bit, we get lost in this discussion of rules, to consider the purpose of the rules that are proposed to be repealed in this bill. These rules are in place fundamentally to protect our health and the great outdoor traditions that Minnesotans value so much. These rules are in place to protect our lakes, rivers, and streams that supply our drinking water, provide our kids a place to swim, and fishing for our anglers. Think, if you will, of wastewater effluent standards and how they regulate our waste that flows into our water. These rules also protect our air quality, which means fewer of our children will get asthma and fewer Minnesotans will have health problems from air pollution. Think, if you would, of mercury and the recent report documenting that 1 in 10 newborn children in the Lake Superior Basin of Minnesota have unsafe levels of mercury in their blood. We've been aggressively going after mercury reduction for a number of years, but still 1 in 10 newborns have unsafe levels of mercury in their blood. And these rules also ensure that future generations can continue our Minnesota traditions of hunting and fishing. These rules protect our great outdoors. Think, if you will, about the seasons for hunting and fishing across the state of Minnesota. This bill repeals everything from air and water protections to hazardous waste and pipeline safety. It creates an unbalanced assessment of rules that looks to the cost of implementing a rule, but not to the cost to us as citizens of the state for not implementing the rule. What is the downside when we don't reduce mercury emissions? What is the cost of unsafe levels of mercury in newborns' blood? I have a handout here I'd just like to share with the committee if I could. Someone who can distribute it. So oftentimes when you're in the legislature, you kind of get in the middle of a lot of discussion that goes on inside the Capitol, and it's not always easy to get an accurate assessment, a scientific assessment of where the public is on these issues. I want to share with you a couple of questions from a recently completed poll that we did last month. We hired two nationally recognized polling firms, one Republican firm, one Democratic firm, to ask Minnesotans what they thought about energy and environmental issues. And these are the results on a couple of questions. Number one, Minnesotans, as you might guess, overwhelmingly believe that we can have a strong economy and a clean environment at the same time. Overwhelmingly, not a big surprise, 79%. Now, there's some of those that think we should weigh to the environmental side and some we should think to the economic side. But on the other side is more interesting. Two-thirds of voters want better enforcement or tougher environmental laws. And because of the issues that came up last session, we went out and asked Minnesotans, what do you think? What do you think, folks? We asked 500 people across the state, should environmental laws be made tougher, or are they tough enough and we should just do better enforcement? And two-thirds of the public agreed with one of those options. Or are they about the same? And a full 86% agreed with the same or tougher. Merely 12% said we should actually be loosening up environmental regulations. And you can see in the bottom of this sheet, it also breaks it up by party. And it doesn't matter if you're Democratic, Independent, or Republican. These are Minnesotan values. And even amongst Republicans, where we have the least support for maintaining environmental regulations, fully 75% of people who self-identify as Republicans say we should keep what we have or make it tougher, with most of them saying make it tougher, either through enforcement or laws. Oops, excuse me. So, Mr. Chairman and members, in wrapping up, I would just like to say also as a former commissioner-level staff person that rules are actually the way that we put sidebars, if you will, on the authority of the agencies. Now, if you want to increase the latitude of the agencies and allow the commissioner a lot more discretion and make decisions that perhaps aren't consistent and haven't been reviewed through a public process, take away the rules. Because what the rules do, and I've always thought it was good government, you go through the rulemaking process, it's a transparent public process where you can put your ideas on the table, they can be reviewed by the public, they're put into law, and the agency has to follow those so there's some consistency. Doing away with them will mean less consistency. In closing, we ask that this committee oppose this legislation. We believe it's excessive, unwarranted, and in fact unreasonable because it does repeal the core of our environmental rules. We can do better for Minnesota's future by allocating then by allocating the increasingly limited resources of agencies' time and energy to reauthorizing through the legislature hundreds of rules that protect our air, our water, and our health. And thank you. I'll be happy to stand for any questions.
Thank you, Senator Morse. Any questions of our testifier? Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate that. Is there somebody from the Chamber of Commerce here that would like to testify? Please state your name and you may proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis. I am the Director of Environmental Policy for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the time this afternoon, Mr. Chairman, to testify in support of Senate File 1922, and I will be brief. I know committee time is short. The Chamber supports this bipartisan approach to regulatory reform, Mr. Chairman, members, using the already existing LCC process. We think it is a good way to go through and just review proposed rules that are going to be put forth by the agencies. Additionally, but more importantly, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we think it establishes a way to go through and review and identify obsolete and duplicative rules that might be out there. And this kind of dovetails along with Governor issued an executive order. I think it's 11.32, where he asked the Environmental Quality Board to go through and find ways to streamline and find duplicative and obsolete rules and other mandatory categories in the environment arena. And we think this is a good way that kind of dovetails with that, and as Senator Peterson has pointed out, kind of in a bipartisan fashion. So I just wanted to get on the record, Mr. Chairman and members, that the Chamber is in support of Senate File 1922.
All right, thank you very much. At this point in time, Senator Peterson, I'm going to lay this on the table. We are going to bring it up. We're running short on time. We've seen two opposing sides testify here, and we will do that.
Mr. Chairman,
we will let you know when we're going to sneak this in. We're going to try quickly. Senator Cohen.
Will there be a chance for witnesses in case of Mr. Quillis?
I'm sure there will be.
By the way, he's a former Senate staffer.
Okay. Thank you very
DFL
much.
DFL Senate staffer, I might add. Right.
I'm going to ask one quick question.
Senator Goodwin.
Where do you plan on this going from here?
This will ultimately end up in agriculture.
Okay.
After this committee.
Mr. Chair, are you recommending that it go to all of the committees that it affects then?
At this point in time, this is agriculture is its next stop. So, all right, we'll lay the Senate File 922 on the table. There being no further business, this meeting is adjourned.